You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Well, folks, for many years, anything that has been written or produced about Jonestown, I've been kind of interested in, not sort of fixated on. It doesn't kind of, you know, take over my life like I know some people out there have experienced. But I have always found it very fascinating. And back on November 18th, 1978, in a remote jungle settlement named Jonestown, after, of course, its leader, Reverend Jim Jones, 918 United States citizens died in a suicide massacre. An estimated 93% of those who died were African American. It was the largest number of civilian lives lost in the United States. This included U.S. Congressman Leo Ryan and his entourage. They were assassinated at the airport as they were about to board a plane. His assassination marked the first and only death of a U.S. congressman in the history of the United States. And after surviving 16 months in the armed jungle compound at the age of 21, on the morning of November 18, 1978, Leslie Wagner Wilson and nine others escaped Jonestown, walking 30 miles through the jungle. And strapped to her back was a 40-pound care package, her son, later to be known as the youngest survivor of Jonestown. Within the next 2 days, she would learn that all of the residents of Jonestown had died, including her husband, mother, brother, sister, niece, nephew, sister-in-law, brother-in-law, and friend she'd grown up with and loved since the age of 13. Years later, after post-traumatic stress, survivor's guilt, drug addiction, and family suicide, Leslie joins us to share her incredible story. And you also want to check out her website, slaveryoffaith.com. Leslie, I know you hear this every time you do an interview, but it really is, you know, our honor to have you here on the Drew Marshall Show. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Drew, for having me. Thank you so much for having me on.
How many interviews would you do in a year? Are people still sort of wanting your attention?
They actually are, and I think it's only because people want to know now the truth, and because I wrote the book Slave of Faith, that's given people an inside look at what it was like to grow up in People's Temple and then to go through Jonestown and the years after that. So, yes, there's still an interest.
I actually have too much information that I processed. I mean, I spent too much time researching you because I just find this subject fascinating. I've got my childhood friend here beside me, Andy, who's co-hosting the show, and he and I have talked about these sorts of stories over years, and it really still captivates people's attention. It's amazing.
Well, it should. Because it was, you know, like you mentioned, it's the largest loss of civilian life before, you know, post 9/11.
All right. Well, let's do a little chronological thing here, if you don't mind. Growing up in a middle class family, right? Upper middle class family, going to church. You went to a non-denominational type of church, I think. Is that right?
You're correct.
See, I always had the impression that the majority of people at Jonestown were low-income Black people.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate or no?
It's not. We had doctors and lawyers and, you know, nurses. We had professionals. And then, we had a lot of senior citizens. And we had people that were active and, you know, professionals. And we also had those that, you know, had come off of drugs and that were homeless. And so, no, that's not accurate. It was a wide variety of people.
Okay. Now, when you were young, your parents were divorced when I think you were around 10?
Mm-hmm.
Would you say prior to all this Jonestown stuff that that was the most traumatic thing that had happened in your life, or was there other garbage and baggage?
No, that was the most traumatic.
Yeah.
That was the most traumatic.
And, I mean, were you sort of, again, I got the impression that a lot of the people that were part of the Jonestown community were sort of lost, or, you know, it was back in the, you know, the sort of the hippie, you know, self-exploration days, and let's try this and let's try that, but was that you as well? Or that was more your sister, from what I understand.
Right. My sister, you know, it was the late 60s, and she got caught up in the acid and LSD, the drugs, and my mother was desperate to find some help, and a friend of hers informed her or shared with her about a church and people, you know, in Redwood Valley, which was we lived in Santa Rosa at the time. And so that's how we became introduced to the church, was because they had a youth drug rehab program. And we proceeded to go up there for about a year and then finally made the total move to Ukiah. which was the town right outside of River Valley where the church was centered.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we came on board.
The attraction for you into the what was the church called again? The denomination?
People Simple.
Sorry, say again.
People Simple.
Right, it was part of a larger denomination, right?
It was Disciples of Christ.
Right.
Right.
And now these days they're pretty much known as sort of a liberal outfit. Were they then?
I can't say. I would say probably so, because I think then the ordination process was totally different than what it is now for him to become a pastor.
Right.
But again, it really wasn't a church. He used that title to legitimize what the organization actually was. So for me, coming in at 13, I was indoctrinated into a socialist lifestyle.
Right. So it wasn't like you were some teenage hippie, you know, trying out a new club of interesting people. The reality was that you were 13 and your mom kind of brought everybody into it.
Exactly.
What did your dad, was he part of this, or what did he think about it?
No, we never spoke to, you know, I think that we never spoke to my dad about it. My brother was still allowed to go with my father, which is rare because he had joint custody and spent, you know, time with him. And but my dad was actually one of the concerned relatives and luckily, you know, thank God he didn't show up at Jonestown. It would have been difficult for me to get out.
Yeah.
But I believe my brother was brought over to Guyana without his permission. That I'm pretty sure of.
And I know you've been asked this a thousand times, so let's just get over this question. Mm-hmm. The first warning signs that you began to see that, you know, things were a little wacky. And 2020, right? Hindsight is always 2020. So I'm sure as years go by, you can look back on different memories and go, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think when we were in the States, I saw things that were not correct. I mean, we grew up in an upper middle class family. We weren't religious, you know, my father was an atheist, but we still had spiritual background just from me visiting my grandparents during the summers, and they were devout Baptist deacon and deaconess of the church, etc. So I had that experience of knowing who God was at a young age. I think in the church in San Francisco, in Redwood Valley, I started noticing Jim saying that, you know, he needed to buy a Mercedes because he needed protection. By that time, he was calling himself God.
What?
And claiming that he was God. And so that kind of struck with me differently. And
you think?
Yeah, oh, wow. A little, right? A little.
Jeez.
But again, I'm young, and so I'm looking at all these adults that are caught up in this, so it must be me. And the brainwashing was very swift and strategized. And as I got older, you know, I spent my youth, you know, I didn't go to the high school prom. I couldn't participate in the tennis team. I was a pretty good tennis player. Our time as youth was writing letters all night, trying to get people out of prison or doing security at the church and traveling on the buses up and down, you know, from San Francisco or River Valley to Los Angeles. So we were just fully indoctrinated. But I just started noticing some things that weren't right, such as us having to sign blank pieces of paper to incriminate ourselves in case we left the church. And all, you know, boxing matches, public discipline, you know, paddlings and such. And the humiliation that you get called on the floor on a Wednesday night because someone said that you said something negative. So these things didn't sit with me. And as I got older, I started really seeing that I'm not sure this is really what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
The only reason I went to Jonestown was because Jim took my son with him when he made the exodus out of the United States.
Right. So, again, just to summarize this, you have a son. Your son goes – did he go with your ex-husband?
No, he went with a friend of mine who was like who was like a sister. And,
oh, okay.
Right, and I loved that.
But listeners would go, whoa. Why would you let your son go with, you know, a friend and Jim Jones down to Guyana?
Mm-hmm. And that's a good question. The reason was because, you know, the nuclear family was broken up. That's what he did. He'd break up the nuclear family. And our children were raised by everybody else in the church, pretty much. And so at that time, I had one foot in the church and one foot out of the church, and I thought it was the best thing for him because I'm not a good mother, because I'm not a good socialist anymore. So being brainwashed, I thought that he'd be okay.
Okay.
But what happened was about 2 months later, I got this phone call. I was in this apartment that I thought they forgot about me, and they said, you want to go to Jonestown? And the first voice, and I say that was God speaking to me, not even knowing then, said, if you don't go now, you'll never see your child again. And I followed that spirit of what I heard and went. That's the only reason I went to Jonestown.
Leslie, it's Andy here, and I think a lot of people, and myself included, weren't aware that, you know, this whole started in California, and they created that compound down in Jonestown, I guess, a number of years later when I guess there were some threats or they figured they needed to move off the continental United States. So that was a little bit enlightening from my perspective. But it sounds like just what you're saying right now is that you kind of had one, like you said, one foot in, one foot out. You always had this somewhat doubt about what was happening. And I guess, you know, it leads to the end of the story, which we're not getting there yet, but around the fact that you were able to actually separate yourself and eventually make the decision to leave. It sounds like that was in your brain the whole time.
When I got to Jonestown, you know, I felt like I was redeemed. I would be with my son. I would try to become a good socialist. I would try to adapt to whatever I had to adapt to. And I did for a while. I was supposed to be sent to Cuba to become a doctor. And I started work in the medical field and started seeing discrepancies or, you know, some people getting services that they should have, other people, you know, not getting the care that they needed because maybe they were rebellious or whatever. And so it didn't take long for me to realize that Jonestown was not somewhere that I wanted to be nor raise my son, because there was no talk of the future. There was no talk of, you know, me being a doctor was kind of thrown out the window. And I just started seeing things that just weren't correct. And Jim, of course, had total control of us then. We were totally isolated from the outside world. We heard nothing but what he gave us. He could have said there was a nuclear war, and we would have believed it because we had no way of knowing there wasn't.
And yet, you had one, and at that point, you had, at least the expert on your website, talked about the fact that you attempted to get help. You tried to get away at one point to get to Georgetown?
I went to Georgetown on the time that I lost my glasses, trying to get the U.S. Embassy.
Right, you were hiding your glasses, and then you said that you had to go and get another prescription, and I guess the thought there was at least the first part of an escape, or at least to let people know what was really happening there.
Right, just to get out and get help, because I would not leave my son, not then.
Okay, so, you know, the one thing that I... watching the documentaries, watching the footage, listening to that last audio tape. I mean, I've listened to it a number of times over the last number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Man, Jones had a filthy, filthy mouth on him when he preached. I actually know a preacher in Hamilton who does the same kind of a thing. Just an absolute potty mouth preacher. That should be his title, potty mouth preacher.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I've heard Jim Jones go off his face in anger and rage, and every second word had to be bleeped out. And he also preached openly, or talked openly, spoke openly about being bisexual as well.
Right.
So, again, I look at that as an outsider and go, what the heck did everyone see in this whack job?
And that's true, and that was one of the things. I mean, we were taught, you know, sex from the pulpit, and he talked about having men and women because he wanted to make sure that they were, you know, didn't go out into society and that they could, you know, continue to be a good socialist. And I used to, we talk about hindsight, is why did my mother leave then? What was the pull? And I can't speak for everybody else. I can only speak for me. What made her stay? So it's finding a vulnerability, what was missing in people's lives that they would compromise so much.
Yeah.
So much.
Do you think Jim Jones started out with good intentions and then evil slipped in, or was he deceptive right from the start?
I think it was from the beginning.
Wow.
He was diagnosed as a manic depressant way back when he was in Indiana.
Okay, so the story of you getting to Jonestown is fairly clear. Your son is there. Your husband is there. Your husband and you, obviously, you're not getting along that well. There might be a little some separation stuff going on. But, you know, if I toe the party line, I can. This shouldn't be too hard to do. I'm going to get back in. I'm going to go move down there, get my son. My husband and I are trying to work things out, right? You're really looking towards not only a spiritual utopia, but a personal utopia as well.
Absolutely.
And then you get down there, and how long were you there for before the massacre took place, the mass suicide took place? How long?
16 months.
During those 16 months, how were you brainwashed? Because we've heard about your doubt being there all the way along. But I'm sure you got sucked in somehow, some way.
Not really. I think I was sucked in only because, you know, God is amazing. Because I think for me to, you know, even during the suicide drills that we had, that I didn't take that in as a realization. I don't think I would have been able to make it if I had it. So I pretended to be what I was supposed to be, and the whole time trying to, you know, at a certain point deciding that I really wanted to get out, and not knowing how, and that's where faith comes in, because I had no inkling on how this was going to happen, but I knew at some point it would. So I had to pretend like I was happy. I had to, and for a minute I was. I adjusted. You know, luckily was raised in a family that, you know, my mother taught us to be adaptable, so I adapted. But as I started seeing things happening and him on the microphone and, you know, pulling us out in the middle of the night saying that we were attacked, you know, we're being attacked by outside forces, it just got to be too much. But it was very strategic in how he broke us down. We were malnourished. You know, we weren't eating properly. We had lack of sleep. We were working, you know, if you weren't, I think I worked 3 or 4 days in medical field and the rest of the time, in, you know, out in the fields. So you're working 6 days a week. We're exhausted, totally exhausted.
You know, one of the things I picked up about Jim Jones is that he had a gift of being, dare we say it like this, a gift of being like a chameleon. In other words, he could, depending who the crowd was that he was speaking to or preaching to, especially back in San Francisco, how did he get all those politicians and great leaders on side? He knew how to play the people in front of him. So he had this chameleon-like gift. And I would say that that's an adaptability. And so if he's adaptable and you're adaptable, maybe that's one of the reasons you never bought into the whole program, hook, line, and sinker, because you had a similar kind of ability to be able to adapt. Mm-hmm. And so you could sniff out his insanity.
Right.
Does that make any sense?
It does, and it's true. I mean, he was definitely a chameleon. He could, you know, that's why the numbers grew so much. We had people that were revolutionaries, you know, they were, you know, rebels. We had people that were religious, so-called, or seeking for something different. So he could get in the, in the pulpit, and just reach out to anybody on any level at any time.
Okay, now going around, you're getting a bad vibe. You're thinking, I got to get out of here, but you got to get help from others, because here's the weird part of this. One of the weird parts of this story is your husband, whom you're separated from, is the head of security.
Mm-hmm.
Or was one of the big kahunas in security? Was the head or one of the big cheeses?
He wasn't the head. He actually took over once the boy, once the basketball team, who actually pretty much contained Jim's sons, went to Georgetown. Then he was over security at that point.
Well, that's even more interesting, because the basketball team was in Georgetown on the morning of this suicide, but your husband was not. He was back in the compound.
Right.
So he was part of the Red Brigade.
He was part of security. He was always part of security.
What's the Red Brigade? I mean, I understood that to be just the security detail.
That was what it was. Just, okay. You know, those that were in security. And like I said, the majority was, of course, Jim's sons and then those others.
Right. So a couple questions come out of this. First question is, and I guess this is pure speculation, I wonder if Jim Jones planned that day. I guess it's kind of hard. I don't know. I'm just trying to get into his head and thinking, okay, all his sons happened to be in Georgetown at a basketball tournament the day that this whole thing went down. That seems a little strange. Number two, your husband, who's supposed to be with the basketball team as part of his detail, is not with the basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
He's on campus, so to speak. Mm-hmm. He's at Georgetown.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is, I think I'm barraging you with like 60 different questions here. The other thing is, how do you go about finding someone who will align themselves with you that you can trust to plan an escape? Because if you're found out, it's not good.
It's not good.
Especially with your husband being on the security detail.
Right. Well, that happened. You know, what Jim created was paranoia. Again, he split the nuclear family, so you couldn't trust anyone, not even your own family. And I happened to meet a woman who we felt each other out for a while to see, you know, where our heads were at. And she told me that her boyfriend, Richard Clark, and I call him our Moses on that day, was developing an escape plan. And I asked to be a part of it. And she...
Well, they wouldn't like that, because you used to be married to Mr. Security Guy.
Right. Well, and that was the thing. And so what they came back was you could go. We voted you in to go, but you could not know who else was going with them. And I said, that's fine, because I'm taking my child. And that's how I was able to get out.
I understand the turning point for you, like I'm sure that's the question you get asked all the time. What was the final straw? What was the thing? Was it Shonda's rape?
It was. It was Shonda's rape.
So you have a good friend named Shonda, and she's raped by Jim Jones.
Yep, she's raped by Jim Jones.
Is Shonda still with us?
No, Shonda died in Jonestown.
She died in Jonestown.
Because,
Again, after being raped by Jim Jones, you'd think you'd want to escape.
Well, that's the thing, and I don't know. People at that time, people were just, you know, I could say that, you know, and I call it a suicide massacre, because a lot of people, you know, babies don't commit suicide. Children don't commit suicide.
Over 200 murdered children.
Right. And they also, they only had 12 autopsies, and what they found was a lot of people were injected in the shoulder blades. And so that reeled me. Sean is right, because I thought he has really, really lost his mind. And what, not just him, but the people around him that knew that this happened, was just really disturbing to me. And I just said, it's time to go. It's time to go.
Who do you think was more evil, Jim Jones or his inner circle?
All of them. Because I think at the end point, Jim was in no condition. This could have been stopped. Because Jim was in no condition, I think I heard someone say maybe he would have lived another 2 months. His body was, everything was starting to shut down.
Yeah, I mean, you listen to him talk in those tapes, and he is slurring unbelievably.
Right, and I don't remember seeing him 2 weeks before the 17th of November.
What do you mean he wasn't around? Like
we just heard the tapes. We didn't see him because they said, you know, he wasn't well.
Huh.
So, the inner circle were the ones that, you know, it did not have to happen the way it did. But it was planned, because the cyanide was bought months and months before. Because also Jim was a prisoner, which we didn't know. We had the IRS was after him, you know, the State Department. There was foster children, Social Security fraud. There was a lot of legal issues where, you know, the custody battle, where he could not step foot even in Georgetown. And so he was actually a prisoner. You know, he was a prisoner. We didn't know that, though. We wouldn't know that.
Okay, so let's jump right to the actual day.
Okay.
How did you know that it wasn't just another white knight rehearsal?
I didn't. This is how God moves. I didn't know that it was not another night. I know that Richard Clark came to us. We were going to leave on the 17th, and he said, no, we're going to leave the morning of the 18th because it would be so much activity. So it was...
Well, how did he know there was going to be that much activity?
Well, because the congressman was there. And so we heard the night before that people had passed notes saying that they wanted to leave.
Okay.
And so he said, we're going to leave, you know, that morning. And we met at the kitchen, and, you know, Joe came and grabbed, you know, where are you going? And this is what's so amazing, that we said we're going on a picnic. Well, you don't have a picnic in Jonestown because you have no access to food.
Yeah.
You can't go in the refrigerator and make a sandwich and take, you know, have a picnic. But it was such a crazy, you know, excuse that they couldn't have fanced, but it didn't even register that this is impossible. And so that's how we left. You know, I was able to at least go to my mother and tell her I loved her, and she looked at me with this look, you know, a picnic. And I'm like, yes, you know, a picnic. And I was able to, you know, give her a hug, kiss her, tell her I loved her before I left, not knowing that was going to be the last time that I saw her.
Leslie, did you know that there'd been the shootings at the airport that seemed to kind of...
No.
Would finalize things? No?
No,
because we left that morning, so by the time we got, I think, you know, the train passed us while we were walking, and by the time we got to Matthews Ridge, it was dark. We had been on the road, you know, for hours walking. And that's when we discovered that the shootings happened at Port Kaituma, when the captain of the police station, you know, pulled guns on us, thinking that we were involved.
Yeah, here's the chronology. They decide to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Jim Jones comes out and they calls everyone for a big meeting. And during this meeting, you can hear it on the audio tapes, it is announced that the congressman has been shot and killed. Mm-hmm. And, of course, by that time, that information has come out. These guys have been on the road for a good chunk of time, correct?
Because at that point, yeah, the jig is up kind of thing. If the congressman had been shot, you know, the timing was perfect, really,
yeah.
In so many ways.
Yeah.
That, that really did push things to the brink, because at that point the U.S. government gets involved, and now they really are going to come down and figure what's happening down there.
Right, right.
How old is your son? Is it Jakara?
Jakari,
sorry.
He's 34.
34. Man, can you believe you have a 34-year-old son?
No, I can't. I'm grandchildren.
Oh, come on. Oh, my goodness. How is he doing? Like,
he's not well. Mm-mm.
How do you mean?
Never has. You know, Jakari's incarcerated now. We're in a process of an appeal. Jakari has always suffered mental illness. You know, he was raised in a violent situation. You know, people's temple was violent. There was a lot of violence. And in the womb, you know, he suffered that. Coming out of the womb, he suffered that. In Jonestown, he suffered that.
Oh, man.
And he never did well, you know. And there's another child also who, Juanita Bogue, who was pregnant on the airstrip, also was pregnant. You know, she was pregnant when she was leaving. Her son actually has a life sentence for shooting an officer in Oakland.
Man.
So those are the remnants of Jonestown. You know,
yeah.
I was traumatized, but the children were also traumatized.
Okay, what happens to you? Well, I guess each person is individual. We all come with our baggage. We all come with different processors. And, I got to ask, you know, what has happened to you spiritually since? Because when you get sucked into something wacky, although you always had that little bit of doubt thing going on, mm-hmm. I would imagine that, you know, that many people, if they survived and got out of it, would go, you know what? I don't think there is a God anymore. And they chuck it all. They say, forget it. Mm-hmm. And then other people, for some strange reason, go right back into another cult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what happened to you spiritually? What has happened to you spiritually over the last 33 years?
I knew, you know, I went to post-traumatic stress. My grandfather, who I loved like a father, committed suicide at 87. And I kept it quiet, so I was very self-destructive. I mean, self-destructive. I did not want to live. Every day when I get out of bed, I'm like, are you kidding me, another day? I was in so much pain. Hmm. They didn't talk about it. I didn't speak about it. I went underground. I changed my name. I never spoke about Jonestown, never told people my experience. And so as time wore on, I started realizing that there was something more that I was supposed to do that certainly, you know, I was not spared by the grace of God and mercy of God to just live a normal life and not to share this testimony. Hmm. In 2007, I got divorced. I hit 50. And so once I hit 50, I realized I was on the way out. And I am, you know, I brag about my age because I didn't think I was going to see the, you know, 21. And so once I you know, got divorced, moved to Atlanta, and began this really spiritual journey, and then realizing that I know there's a God because I know there's a reason for me being here, that I didn't walk out of Jonestown the morning of just to not be able to do something that was positive and to help people. And so I couldn't go to church. I tried to go to many churches, and I was suspicious, of course. And finally, I had to do it on my own. So I got very, very quiet. Lived in an apartment with just a bed and my, you know, nothing else, and just went to work and came home and started trying to learn how to pray. And turned vegetarian, which really just opened things up for me. And started writing Slavery of Faith. And I had this incredible, I woke up one morning, and I used to envy people that I could tell that they walked in the Spirit of God. They were so loving. They didn't have to profess their belief. It just reeked from their pores, you know, this love. And I envied that. And I thought, I'm never going to be there. I'm never going to get there. Well, I beg to differ. I experienced that. And I woke up, and I had this peace come over me and this forgiveness. I had to forgive Jim Jones, you know, because I couldn't move forward. And just this, and realize that there's this unconditional love that exists, you know, through our Lord and Savior. And that's what I did. And so I went the opposite. There's people in the church that are atheists, I mean, that are ex-members that are atheists. Some are doing alternative, you know, religious, whatever. But I knew that I was spared for a specific purpose, and that's the journey now. That's the reason I wrote Slavery of Faith. That's why I interview. That's why I do, you know, I try to speak as much as I can. You know, I was homeless at one point. You know, I've been through abuse, you know, an abusive marriage. So God gave me all these things to experience, but it was to be able to help people.
Have you learned to stop picking losers for husbands?
I have.
Good for you.
And I tell you, you know, when you feel like you're damaged goods, and that's what I felt like.
Yeah.
You know, I had the stigma of Jonestown on me, and I felt like I was damaged, and that's what I chose.
Good for you.
That's what I chose.
Well, let's finish with a couple of quick things. Boy, I could talk to you forever. You're easy to talk to, and mm-hmm. I've just got so many questions, but unfortunately, it's radio, and there's a time
right.
Boundary here. Apparently, Jones was found dead lying next to his chair between two other bodies. His head cushioned by a pillow. This is all apparently, because different reports say different things. His death was apparently caused by a gunshot wound to his left temple. And the Guyanese coroner stated that was consistent with a self-inflicted, you know, gunshot wound. What do you know about Jim Jones' death? Other than, do you have any inside scoop on this?
I don't. There's nobody there to tell it. I mean, it's what, you know, I saw a picture of him and Jones when we got into Georgetown. They showed me a picture of him dead, and I thought, that's not him, because he had a decoy one time. I couldn't believe that, you know, he would die. Was it self-inflicted? I seriously doubt that. I can't imagine. I mean, you know, why not just take the poison like everybody else and suffer the way everyone else suffered?
Yeah.
A coward.
Man. Who are you in touch with that also escaped? Anybody these days?
I am, actually. The Cobb family, Jim Cobb and his family.
Okay.
Stephen Jones, I just saw him a couple last month at a luncheon.
That's one of the sons?
His natural son.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're, you know, since the book came out, I've really opened up and welcomed that. And, you know, there's no blame anywhere because we all were, you know, we all were at the place that we were at. And it's just a lot of love. There's a lot of love still there because we experienced something that, you know, nobody, you can't connect with people that did, you know, there's just not that connection.
You know, I saw there's a sign above what looks to be like sort of a pulpit at Jim Jones that reads, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it."
Right.
Was that, it was above a chair that was elevated on a bit of a platform. What was that?
That was what he used to talk about was, you know, Hitler, that we can't repeat the same things that people did in the past, you know, and he always had that. That was over his chair.
You know, this. There's so many things about this that drips with irony. It's just, oh, man. Okay, listen. Speaking of reeking, you reek of grace and love. You really do. The interviews I've watched you do and heard you talk, I like you is what I'm trying to say.
Thank you.
I just hope God does something crazy, amazing, cool. I'm losing my words here because I'm starting to sound like an 8-year-old. But way to go is what I'm trying to say. I don't know how else to say it.
I mean, he's moving in my life. And I want to say, you know, I'm an old school shout out to RP, who's from Berkeley, who's my, you know, mentor, spiritual guide, and special friend. And
what up, RP?
Andy Edmonds. There's a lot of people I could say thank you to. But I think I am just, you know, I'm blessed. Blessed, and I'm grateful for everything. The only regret that I have, Drew, is that the people Jonestown felt like they didn't have a choice to live.
Yeah.
That's my only regret.
Leslie, thank you. Thank you so much. It's been just an honor to talk to you.
Thank you, Drew.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Leslie Wagner on The Drew Marshall Show. We were going to play an audio clip of Jim Jones' last speech. But I've made a last-minute audible here because the FBI has these tapes that they found there, which was the speech that Jim was giving to everybody, rallying them to go and line up and take the cyanide. And you can the main reason I didn't play it is, I guess, out of honor to Leslie. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's just too Jerry Springer-ish.
Yeah, let's end on the good and not on the bad, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the other reason is, throughout the whole tape, you can hear children screaming and crying, I mean, gut-wrenching screams in the background as they injected cyanide down their throat. So it's just shocking, shocking stuff. But something, boy, we got to learn. We got to learn from this stuff. Unlike, what Jim Jones was trying to say with that sign behind him, you know? We're destined to repeat the past if we don't learn from it.
I'd be interested in
that. Was so ironic.
Hearing what Leslie would have said about Branch Davidians and David Koresh 15 years later, I'm sure that must have brought it all to the surface.
Sure. Can you imagine her seeing those things?
Because you say, we got to learn from this, and it's like, I don't think we learned. There's still some of these guys out there.
Exactly. Okay, a short break. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show on Joy 1250.
Maybe you've been thinking about advertising your organization on the radio, but don't really have the budget for a long-term marketing campaign? Well, what if we gave you a show? The Drew Marshall Show is currently offering an innovative advertising concept for the small business owner or charity. With web stats and listenership at an all-time high, Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show is offering you an opportunity to partner with us, one show at a time. Consider sponsoring one show and we'll introduce you to our listening audience for the day. Drew will mention your organization every hour during our 4-hour show, including a live phone interview. We'll also post your logo and website link on our website for an entire month. If you're thinking about promoting a special event, product, or upcoming sale, or if you just want to test the radio advertising waters without a huge investment, then consider becoming a one-day advertising partner with The Drew Marshall Show. Go to drewmarshall.ca for details or call Joy 1250 on 905-845-2821, extension 367. That's 905-845-2821, extension 367.